companies reporting?
So always a busy world in small cap land, yeah, and I've had a typically varied day in terms of just come out of a company meeting, did another client meeting earlier, now I'm doing a podcast. So,
yeah, that's all right.
It's a good day.
And Easter holidays?
Yes, I have two children and no childcare at the moment, so that's fun.
Are they just at home chilling?
Yeah, they're just on their own. They're 8 and 6 and just at home on their own. No, they're not. They're with my mum today.
So. Nice ages, 8 and 6.
Yeah, the golden years.
Yeah.
I have a coach, and that's what she calls it. She says from the ages of about 4 to 10. You might get a little bit more than 10. It just sort of depends on how quickly you grow up. But she said enjoy them. They're the golden years, which always sounds like a bit of a threat. Because what's coming afterwards?
Yeah. People, a lot of clients, sort of people have said to me, yeah, enjoy it while you can, because big kids, big problems. Yes. We found out this morning our three-year-old has got into the place, into the school with our six-year-old.
Oh, that's good.
And the first thing she said was, do I get to go today, mummy? Which is quite nice. And then the six-year-old said to her, he said, now the thing is, Isla, when you go to school, it's not playtime all day. You actually have to do some work.
So
I'm
sweet.
I'm not sure she took that very well, but that's good news.
Charlie goes to... So he's pre-prep, last year pre-prep, so he's first year prep next year.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently there's a lot more work that needs to be done.
So homework.
Homework.
Yeah.
I
have to get my times table calculations out again.
Yes, that's when it becomes quite scary, when you realise that you've forgotten how to do primary school maths.
Yeah.
Long division.
I know.
What is the point?
Calculators for that these days.
Well, the good news, Victoria, is you're here on episode 50.
Oh,
50, wow.
Yeah. We've made it.
Wow. Oh my goodness, I feel honoured.
It's a decent cricket score, though, isn't it?
Hughesy had hair in episode 1.
The sheer stress of it.
John definitely wasn't grey.
No, that's true. It was this marker that did that. Mm. So
and how
thank
was it
you.
Conceived? Just what was there?
That's a good point.
Possibly in
background.
The pub.
Yeah, it was in the pub. We had a great discussion one evening in the pub between quite a few of us, and someone was an ex-colleague was there, and he said, and he used to do a lot of work for the company in terms of writing and marketing and events and things, and it was his idea, and he said, I think clients would really benefit from hearing what we think about, you know, who we meet, who we talk to, you know, a bit. I think we're, you know, like most houses, very good at the polished kind of information, you know, the smart reports, the quick bits of info. And I think our idea with this was to be more relaxed, get some personality across, and get some different people in.
So
that was it.
We better make a start, we. You got your
Indeed.
Presentation to do later on. So
I have.
Victoria needs to get home
to get
going. Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 50 of Call to Chief. It's Taking Stock After the Bell. Joined as always by James Hughes. James.
Hello.
Good afternoon. And also delighted to be joined by Victoria Stevens. Victoria, hello.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
No problem. Victoria is a fund manager in the Economic Advantage team at Lion Trust. She joined the team in June 2015 to help research and analyse investment opportunities. Primarily across the small cap universe. She previously worked for 5 years at the specialist broking firm FinCap Limited, latterly as deputy head of corporate broking. Prior to that, Victoria was senior reporter and diary editor at financial newspaper City AM, having studied modern languages at Oxford University. So thank you for your time and joining us today. And we thought we'd have a nice afternoon talking about UK small cap, which it's fair to say has been somewhat in the doldrums.
It has, but we're very bullish about where we go from here. So it's nice to see some renewed interest in the asset class and its attractions.
Good, good. I wanted to ask you, sort of start by asking you your journey. I mean, that's a bit cliche, isn't it? But like how you got into fund management and whether you feel that your background and experiences have shaped you as an investor and how they've shaped you as an investor. So it's a slightly big question to kick off, but...
Yeah, absolutely. It's a good question because it's probably... not a traditional route into the industry. So as you said in your introduction, you know, I studied modern languages at university, and that's definitely not a traditional route into the finance industry. But I guess I felt that by doing a degree like that, I felt that it was almost deliberate on my part, because I didn't want to be pigeonholed into any particular career at the end of it. And I remember I was in my fourth year, I'd just been away, having a year out in France and in Germany. as part of my degree in my third year. And I was in my fourth year, and I remember my mum saying, "Now you," because she was a doctor, right?
Yep.
Right from the very beginning, you know, you set up to be a doctor and you go through all of those quite formulaic steps in terms of what you study and then going to study medicine at university. And she said, "You really must think about what you're going to do afterwards, and you need a plan. So I think you should be a lawyer." I said, okay. So I went through the sort of all the process to get embarked and enrolled on a law conversion course. And I was so close to kind of hitting that button in terms of applying. And I suddenly thought to myself, sitting in my room, I don't want to be a lawyer. Yeah. Why am I going with what my mother's telling me to do? So have the confidence in yourself and actually just explore various avenues of work. So that's why post university, I always knew I loved to write. I kind of loved the media. And so I thought, you know, I'll go and get a bit of work experience in various different places. And that was quite varied. I did, I think, a couple of weeks at a women's lifestyle magazine, and then ended up going to, I did a week, 2 weeks actually, at the Croydon Advertiser, which was extremely exciting. And then as part of that, I went to City AM for some work experience. And at the end of that, they offered me a more permanent placement. And it was a fantastic couple of years, you know, really, really interesting, really varied at a small business like that. As you all know, you know, you get a lot of opportunity to prove yourself. And if you prove yourself to be hungry and wanting to take opportunity and lean in, to use that awful phrase, then you get rewarded for that. But it quickly became apparent to me that it wasn't necessarily where I wanted to be long term. But it had given me a real insight into how varied a career in the financial markets could be. Yeah. And in doing so, I met and interviewed the female chief executive of the broker that I ended up joining, FinCap, a very impressive entrepreneurial lady called Sam Smith. And again, in a similar vein, actually, she and one of the other corporate brokers there took me to lunch and offered me a job. So I embraced that opportunity with open arms, worked my way up at FinCap for 5 years, and met my now boss, the head of the Economic Advantage team at Lion Trust, Anthony Cross, very early on in that broking journey. He was one of the first clients that I was handed when I joined. And we hit it off straight away. I thought that his ethos, how he invested in companies, looking for companies, I'm sure we're going to get to it, but looking for companies with these, you know, robust business models, long-term enduring competitive advantage, and being long-term owners of those businesses, it really chimed with me. And so clearly we were close in terms of the broking relationship. And so when it came for him to be time to for him to expand his team, and he offered me the job, I was absolutely delighted to take him up on it. And I've been there for the last 10 years helping to grow that team and assets and funds.
And did you join as an analyst, or did you join as sort of a trainee, I don't know, fund manager, or?
Yeah, the latter. The latter. I think, you know, Anthony was a small team at the time, so it was just Anthony and Julian Foch. And he hired two people together, myself and my colleague Matt Tong. Work husband, if you like. at the same time, Matt had been a 13-year veteran of Lion Trust at that point, but had come into the fund management side from the trading desk. And I think Anthony was very keen that from an early stage of our careers, we were given the chance, within the right framework and with the right supervision, to really feel the weight of our investment decisions, to own those decisions, both positive and negative, because only in doing so, I think we felt that you could really, you know, hone your craft, if you like, and really kind of learn from your mistakes, as well as obviously take the good lessons from your winners.
I think that's really interesting. There's a couple of things there that sort of jump out. The kind of modern language is background. Like, I'm from a very traditional economics and finance university, straight in, like load of exams, brilliant. And I sort of think in fund management in particular, it's actually good to have people in the room who've got very different backgrounds and different skill sets and different, you know, educational background, because it does bring an element of diversity of thought. I think if you had everyone around the table who were all economics graduates, it would be pretty dull, wouldn't it? I mean, you wouldn't. I think having that kind of breadth, and historian, and English grad, modern languages, I think it just brings a lot to the table. And I think that's quite useful, probably, in thinking more laterally when you're coming to think about analysing companies and making investment decisions.
Yeah, that totally chimes with me. I mean, I think we've got all sorts of different backgrounds on our team. Yeah. We've got, you know, everything from politics, philosophy and economics through to modern languages, as I said. We've got an engineering degree within the mix. We've got a physics degree within the mix. And we've got one member of our team who didn't go to university, went straight into the world of work. So we've got a real, as you say, diverse thought process, diversity of thought processes, diversity of backgrounds. And I think that you exactly what you identified is absolutely accurate. Because if you think about it, at the end of the day, you know, we sit in front of people who are running businesses. And those businesses, particularly if you are, you know, a UK all cap specialist, I mean, it's almost a contradiction in terms, because particularly if you're going down to the small cap end of the market, you know, you're not going to get dedicated small cap engineering vehicles or dedicated small cap X vehicles. You know, you're going to be a generalist small cap investor. Now, you might well have a framework, and we have a very firm framework under which we invest, but I think that that diversity of thought, that diversity of background is really, really helpful when it comes to talking to management teams who are operating their businesses in the real world at the end of the day.
Has the way you talk about the framework, and it's quite a rigid framework in terms of how you invest, has that changed at all over the years, or do you think it will change based on market conditions potentially changing, or, you know, the way, I don't know, markets are constructed, or do you think, you know, that philosophy will remain?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think one should never say never to anything, but it is definitely a differentiator for our team that we have this very clear framework under which we invest. And so for your listeners' benefits, and in a very, very short
synopsis. Yeah, I was going to ask
synopsis,
you if you could run through it.
So effectively, we look for businesses that have a significant strength in intellectual capital or intangible asset strengths that we believe are going to give those businesses long-term enduring competitive advantage. And if we get that right on the way in, of course, what that means is that that company can sustain its competitive position for much longer than market theory might suggest and earn excess returns over and above its cost of capital and deliver fantastic share price appreciation over the long run. Now, that doesn't mean to say, and we're going to get to it, that there can't be significant periods of drawdown in the markets, sentiment shifts, there's be cyclicality, of course, within the mix. But ultimately, at its core, that is, this is the way we invest. And we prioritise three intangible assets above all others, and we use them as almost a gateway into our funds. So any company we buy has to have a strength of either intellectual property or a strength in distribution or high levels of contracted recurring income, so really solid business models. And if it doesn't have at least one of those three, it could of course have two or three of those three, then we won't consider it for inclusion. And so that sort of conceptual stage is the first test, if you like. We'll really be analysing the intangible asset strengths below that, elements like culture, customer relationships, like franchise businesses, procedural format skills, and so on and so forth. And the more of those intellectual capital or intangible asset strengths, the better. And then that's almost the subjective first stage, and the second stage is an objective test of the company's cash flow return on invested capital. Effectively, can the company earn an excess return over and above its cost of capital over the course of the economic cycle, an economic value creator? So it's almost the beauty of it lies almost in its simplicity, looking for great businesses with competitive advantage, earning high returns. And then for our smaller companies, and we can get onto the importance of this, we ally with that a really important discipline, which is looking to align ourselves with owner managers of businesses, management teams who have significant skin in the game. So we have a threshold level of 3%, but the average in our Lion Trust UK Smaller Companies Fund is closer to 20% of the equity held by these management teams. And we think that brings a number of different advantages. It clearly aligns them with you, and it's a powerful incentivization tool. But also, really importantly, in small cap, it makes them more conservative in how they run their businesses. So they tend to be less willing to gear up to the hilt in terms of taking on lots of debt or be doing those very big but ultimately very risky acquisitions that can so often be transformational in all the wrong ways rather than all the right ways.
Let's start by going back to small cap in the kind of aggregate. We've got a chart here, which is the Deutsche Numis Smaller Companies Index in green. X investment companies, and then we go down to, which is the bottom 2% of the market, is that right?
That's right, that's the Deutsche Numis 1000.
1000, sorry, yeah, index. XYZ
index.
And then effectively we compare and contrast that with the blue line at the bottom, which is the Deutsche Numis large cap index, which has returned a decent amount, to be fair. This is a pound in total
exactly.
return terms going back to
1955.
And we can see that small cap clearly over the long term has significantly outperformed even large cap, which has done pretty well.
Yeah.
But it's been, you know, phenomenal. Do you want to sort of talk us through some of that kind of small cap premium? Where does it come from? And kind of how are those additional returns being earned in small caps over large caps?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's a great place to start because it brings us right back to why should we all care?
Yeah.
You know, we're here to talk about the fact it's been in the doldrums and that's an opportunity. And the brutal fact of it is that if we look over a very long period of time, the evidence shows that the smallest companies listed on the market have substantially outperformed. And a great driver of that effect over the very long term has been the compounding of higher growth rates over a very, very long period of time. So I think, you know, if we think just conceptually about why might a smaller business be able to exhibit higher growth rates than a large cap business, I think the answer is probably quite clear to everybody who's listening to this podcast. You know, these are often businesses that will either be disruptive to those more staid, steady incumbents in an established market, able to look at things differently without the encumbrances of, you know, having a legacy business to look after. They can often be a lot more agile and nimble in terms of taking advantage of those opportunities. Or potentially they might be looking at greenfield opportunities, creating a whole new market for themselves in a certain way. And so that, at its very simplest, is why you get that small cap effect over time. But I think there's one other really critical lesson to draw from that chart, and it's very obvious to see, of course, when we look at the line, and that is that the line is not smooth, right? So
it's an obvious point,
but it's a really, really important point, which is that that long-termism, when we come to looking at this asset class, is so important because it can be buffeted around to no uncertain degree by externalities, if you like, sentiment shifts around its market and a perception that these smaller businesses might well be more vulnerable to the economic cycle or factors outside their control.
Because I'm, John, if you go back to the previous slide, actually, because I started my career in 2004 with a focus on small cap. And we certainly had a natural tilt to small cap. And, you know, for all the reasons you just listed, it makes perfect sense, which is small companies can be more dynamic. You know, if they do a good job, they can be more transformational.
Absolutely.
You know, but typically owners have more skin in the game. They're not, you know, they are concerned with shareholders, of course, but they're not presenting every week to big institutional fund managers, investors. They haven't got the same pressures on them. They can be a bit freer in terms of actually trying to grow. And, you know, for our clients, it was, if you could take a bit more risk, then going a bit overweight small cap would lead to excess returns. And that sort of happened all the way up to, I'm going to put you on a spot here, but it looks like there's a correction in 2016 for some reason. And then obviously, and then obviously 2020 came along, which was obviously COVID, and for all the obvious reasons, small cap was hit worse. And then we did actually.
GFC, you can see before. I mean, it's all those periods of great dislocations in the market where you get this disproportionate impact on the asset class.
But it feels, I mean, actually looking at the chart, small cap recovered really well out of COVID, which it surprises me on that chart actually. But because it feels since COVID, small cap has really struggled, and I don't know if it's just that large cap has, you know, and particularly large cap US has just been so much better. But it does feel like that the something really changed then, and we are where we are today. So it'd be interesting.
You bring me quite neatly onto the next slide, Hughie.
I mean, it's almost as if we put the slides together like that.
So I was going to put a chart, a bit more sort of recent history of a number of the UK, the FTSE indices, So this goes back to pre-pandemic. We've got the broad index in orange. We've got the large cap in grey, which are both in okay. The AIM index is the lighter blue line, which has been significantly negative over that period and been by far the worst. And then actually the small cap index has been okay, hasn't it? But you can see that since 2021, the small cap index has kind of struggled a little bit, particularly relative to large cap. So, you know, to your point, and I was going to ask a sort of similar adjacent question to Husey, which was, you know, the last 5-10 years seeing, particularly in the US, large cap significantly outperform small cap. And that's on a EPS growth basis as well as a kind of share price total return basis. I guess, is there, just playing devil's advocate, is there sort of something changed in the world, be it, you know, the structure of markets or the political backdrop or the rules and regulations these companies face that mean that maybe the big companies, when we talk about the big US platform tech companies, you know, are they more embedded and therefore can they drive higher growth longer term and small companies struggling to break through? Do you think that's feasible?
I think there's definitely an element of, I don't want to say culpability because it makes it sound like it's a bad thing, but the shift to passive has exacerbated the momentum trade into the biggest companies on the market on the way up.
Yeah,
I suppose, I mean, our funds are UK, you know, equity funds, so I don't want to kind of opine at large about US large cap because it's not an area in which we play. But my perception of the situation is that there is absolutely reason to be exceptionally excited about AI and the technological shift that the world is currently undergoing as another of those, you know, generational structural opportunities and yes, threats as well. And as always happens, or as often happens in markets, you know, you tend to see a lot of excitement, a lot of hype around the early winners from that trade. Yeah, now, who knows? Maybe history won't repeat itself this time. Maybe the early winners from those trades will indeed be the companies that go on and benefit and are the winners for the long term from that. I think more seasoned investors than myself have questioned that, and naturally I question it as well, or at least there is a degree of skepticism there. But I think the point about the, you know, that momentum trade, that shift to passive, is definitely applicable to the UK as well, because of course what happens is as they get bigger, the greater weight of passive money gets invested in them, which fuels the trade and pushes prices and valuations ever higher. And the thing about that is that it works until it doesn't, when you get exactly the same dynamic in reverse. Yeah. And you know, I'm not sitting here with a crystal ball, but I think certainly the events of the last couple of weeks have served to introduce a healthy degree of skepticism in investors, in asset allocators' minds as to whether or not and how much further that trade can or should run.
Because I think going back to that AI hype, if we take it back to 2000 and we had the tech, you know, we had the internet hype, it wasn't just large cap that went nuts.
No.
It was small cap as well.
No.
And that's what we haven't seen this time. You haven't, not I've over seen here, an IPO boom you haven't, you haven't way. Seen no. small cap Yet. Ripping. And that's what I found really confusing in a way, that it's just been, it's been a one-way trade in less than 10 names.
That's that passive momentum.
Yeah. There's two things, though, isn't it?
So do you think that's retail disappearing, that retail is now just in ETFs?
Well, I was going to say you've not seen the IPOs that you did in 1998.
No.
In part because of the big platform companies in the US are buying them before they get there.
Yes.
And secondly, private equity is now a much bigger part of the market. So these stocks are not coming to market anywhere near. I mean, look at ByteDance or Starlink. I mean, these multi-$100 billion companies have not come to market. So they're not public. So you've not seen that. But we digress from small cap anyway. But you know, I'm just sort of fascinated that large cap has had such a, you know, 5-10 year period, but that's not been the case for history. At what point, you know, do we question it or not? And I'm entirely inclined to agree that you do get these long blips and these long kind of periods where small cap goes through underperformance, and we have been through one.
And part of the issue, you know, when we all would like to think that myself and you as well are judged on long-term performance, and that's certainly, and we mentioned the importance of long-term time horizon in small cap in particular, but in equity investing in general, I think it's important. But you know, people will naturally look to more recent time frames. I think if you go back to the previous slide for me just for a second, because I think there's a couple of points that are worth pulling out here. I mean, the point was made about the post-COVID bounce, and you can see that very clearly on the chart. And if we were only to isolate those first 2 years of that time horizon, you know, both AIM and the small cap index would have performed actually very well coming out of COVID. And that's, you know, there was obviously substantial stimulus in terms of policy intervention to prevent Armageddon in those early stages of COVID. And I think as we came out of it, it was almost a big relief bounce and then, you know, a strength of economic demand coming through. Companies at that point, you know, if we were talking to our businesses and our portfolios, were clearly struggling quite a lot on the supply side. So there were those big supply chain dislocations that occurred due to COVID or exacerbated because of COVID. But on the demand side, everything felt really quite healthy. And it wasn't really until 2022 where we started to see a confluence of different factors coming together to cause the dynamics that you can see play out quite clearly on the chart. And I think the small cap is worth mentioning for your listeners, and you guys will both know this, but the FTSE Small Cap Index, the one we're showing on this slide, is the X Investment Trust's version of that index, is probably not a great proxy for the breadth of opportunity in UK small cap. It is now a very narrow, concentrated index of only just over 100 companies compared to almost 700 companies that are listed on the AIM market. That in and of itself has shrunk materially over recent years, but the AIM index is still a much broader market. And of course, the reason that AIM was conceived in the first place, the alternative investment market, was as a junior market, a growth market to support businesses of a size and a scale of, and a stage of their evolution where perhaps the cost and the regulatory burden of a full listing wasn't necessarily appropriate. And so naturally speaking, what we've found over the years is that the kinds of company, and there have been various bubbles in certain isolated sectors on the AIM market. I'm talking from purely from my perspective, stock picking in the way that I was just describing earlier on the podcast. But if we look at, you know, the kinds of businesses where you've ended up with having great successes on the AIM market, they've typically been in those structurally growing, fast growth areas of the market, areas like pharmaceuticals, areas like technology, software and services. So what you found as you entered 2022, and of course the big shift there was the start of an interest rate hiking cycle, is that mechanically, for companies which are smaller and growing more rapidly, that quick rising in the discount rate meant that the present value of their future cash flows was impacted by that dynamic. So understandably in 2022, you got an impact, the smaller, the lower down the cap scale you got because of that. What's happened, for me, of course, it's painful as you're, as an investor in the asset class, but to me that's an entirely rational response to that macroeconomic factor. Unfortunately, what's happened since that point is that because of the flow dynamic in the market, there has been a significant exacerbation of that trend in terms of the underperformance of small and the relative outperformance of large. I mean, it's important that we distinguish between those within the UK market, because as a whole, the UK market has been seeing brutal outflows for a very, very long time. This chart here that you can see. Yeah, so this is data from Calastone. So Calastone tracks the flows into and out of different fund segments from UK investors. And what we have on the chart here are the flows, I would say, into or out of, but unfortunately, mostly out of UK equity funds. So what you can see, and actually if we sort of track it back, I think the stat is that 45 out of the last 46 months have seen outflows from UK equities. And this, I mean, to me, it's very simple. I mean, the laws of supply and demand tell us very early on in our economics journey that if you have, you know, that kind of situation where you've got fewer and fewer buyers and more sellers, then that's going to put pressure on prices, it's going to put pressure on valuations. And for me, that impact has been exacerbated down the market cap chain, where you've got the additional issue of more limited liquidity and also other factors at play, such as that perception that we talked about, that smaller businesses might be more susceptible to the economic cycle and to weakening macroeconomic demand picture. And for the AIM market in particular, there have been question marks raised over its tax advantage status, which has just been unhelpful. In terms of adding uncertainty.
It's been a reasonable amount of AIM companies talking about what have been going full list, haven't they?
Yeah,
Some of the larger ones.
It is.
Which doesn't affect your funds at all, does it?
Doesn't matter to us. We're agnostic as to where they're listed.
Yeah.
We'll happily continue to support them on their journey on the main market. I do think, though, if I take a step back and not just thinking about my funds, but thinking about our funding ecosystem for businesses in this country, I think it would be an absolute crying shame to allow AIM to wither on the vine. Because to me, it's a real competitive advantage for the UK. It's an unusual thing to have a functioning, or until recently functioning, growth company market that is genuinely very, very interested in businesses. We could say £1 billion of market cap and below, but you know, even £200 million and below.
Yeah.
I mean, at its peak, it had about 2,500, 3,000 companies on AIM.
I believe it was more like 1,700, but I would have to go back and have a check. It was certainly vastly in excess of the 700 that we have today.
And I've been, you know, probably like you and certainly John, you know, thinking a lot about the negative flows from the UK and what changes that. And I was thinking before we came into this, maybe I've been thinking about the question the wrong way round, which is not what makes, you know, let's make the UK really attractive and get flows coming back in again. Actually, maybe that's not it. Maybe it's what does the US need to do to really mess themselves up and reverse course? And you know, maybe, and they're doing a good job of it at the moment, but maybe actually it wasn't about making the UK more attractive. It was what happens if another market goes wrong, which just forces investors to have to look elsewhere.
Mm.
And then they start doing the work and realise, gosh, the valuations of these businesses are ludicrous.
Yeah.
I'm just going to, just talking of kind of what can go wrong or right, the chart here of pension fund asset allocation, there's two bits of this chart. The left-hand one shows the asset allocation of UK pensions going back to 1997. I will read the notes just because it's important, but the data incorporates corporate defined benefit schemes, local government schemes, and defined contribution pension schemes, but excludes personal pensions. So it's quite comprehensive. But we can see on the chart that in 1997, 53% of pension assets were in UK equities. And today that number is 4.4%. So it's fallen nearly 90% in that time. Pension funds have effectively been net sellers for that entire period. And then the right-hand bit of this chart sort of tries to give a comparison across country of pension allocation in a global context, and we can say the UK has got a very low allocation to domestic equities compared to everywhere else. The USA, for instance, has 44% of pension assets in US equities. The UK, as I said, has 4% in UK equities. It was something that Simon French talked about when he came on, wasn't it, if you remember rightly?
Yeah.
And I guess the, you know, the back to that fund flows, in my observation, would be like there's no one left to sell. How much more selling can there be if you're already down to 4%? So it, and it's, this comes back to the kind of point about the US almost to a degree. You don't really need things to go right. You just need things to stop going wrong, as in the marginal stops coming out because there is no more marginal pounds to come out.
Yeah.
I think that's very true. So this kind of this dynamic that you've got up on the screen compounds the dynamic we just saw from the Calastone data. In that, as you rightly point out, there has been a very, very marked shift, an asset allocation shift out of equities as a whole.
Yeah.
You can see that very clearly from the chart.
Yeah,
but
true.
Specifically within it, the global, actually, or other, we should say, within it has remained relatively constant, and it is the domestic portion that is heavily sold down. And if we look on the right-hand side just for a second, I mean, that there shows you, in the second column of the right-hand chart, it shows you the pension assets in our system. And you can see, I mean, it's measured in dollars there, but they're saying over $3 trillion of assets sitting in those schemes that you mentioned earlier,
yeah.
which is a huge volume of assets. So if they make even a 1% shift in allocation, that's a huge amount of money coming out. But why has that happened? And I think there are a couple of things to kind of consider in the context of your point, how much more pressure on it can there be?
Yeah.
One is that shift from defined benefit schemes to defined contribution schemes. So with a defined benefit scheme, as we all know, the onus is then on the scheme provider to ensure that they can pay out a specific amount in the future to their policyholders. And if we think about what that's meant for them, as those schemes have increasingly been closed to future accrual, and they've obviously got aging people within them, it's meant that they've constantly been on a cycle of de-risking.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, from an asset allocation point of view, what that's meant is a natural shift from equities into more safe assets like bonds.
And you can see that from the chart on the left, the bond segment.
You can see it very, very clearly.
Increased,
Which is entirely understandable. And it's a structural shift that has played out largely already, as you rightly point out. There has been a shift in the other schemes, asset allocation to UK equities as well, to the LGPS, the local government pension schemes, and the defined contribution schemes, it has been less marked, understandably. But I think from where we are today, I think the real power of these charts is that these have been charts that have been shown repeatedly to the government when it comes to thinking about how do we, as a nation, think more carefully about the value of tax breaks that we give to investors and what we might expect. Let's be honest, what the taxpayer might expect in return for those tax breaks. And on the right-hand side of the chart, as you rightly point out, I mean, the USA perhaps is not the best comparator because obviously as a proportion of the global equity
it's
market,
pretty high anyway.
It is so high anyway.
Australia is one
that the pension minister, the previous pension minister, Emma Reynolds, now the city minister, specifically pulled out in the first speech she made in that role as pensions minister as almost a shining example of the playbook that a country could use to think about how the assets in such schemes could support the domestic stock market and why that might matter.
My sister lives in Australia, and so she's got an Aussie super, as they're called, superannuation, and the default, you know, for her age category, the default asset allocation is something like 50% Australian equities, 25% global equities. And that's a huge amount because the Australian stock market's smaller than the UK stock market.
Yeah. She's just got a couple of telcos and BHP and Rio Tinto.
Australian banks, just mainly Australian banks and miners. BHP's 14% of that index.
Yeah,
it's massive.
Yeah. Wow.
So and then quite a lot of risk.
Yeah, they've got a couple of telcos, haven't they?
Yeah, yes, they do. So, I mean, that's the default, which this comes back to that sort of nudge theory, isn't it? If we were to do the same here, then, you know, we would have a particularly higher allocation to UK equities.
You know, it's not just about the equity, is it? It's, you know, if people, you know, if pension funds are heavily invested in UK companies, you know, should they run into trouble or they need to issue corporate debt or whatever else, or there's opportunities to make acquisitions and they want to tap shareholders, you know, there's way more support behind it. And it's not just about owning. It's all the rest that comes with owning a company.
The ecosystem around it.
Be far more supportive. And I think that's a big failure.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to consider in there, isn't there? It's so multifaceted. But just at its heart, thinking about we give a tax break and we expect something in return in terms of supporting our domestic economy and supporting our domestic businesses. Now, some might argue, well, not all businesses listed on the UK stock market are domestic businesses, and that's definitely true. But of course, that's helpful in terms of the ecosystem of services and the earnings 100%. Potential of the economy that sits around those businesses listed on the stock market. And of course, it means that they are so much more likely to consider, you know, headquartering or having significant presence here in the country. And I think there's a natural moral argument for considering being more supportive of the businesses on the stock market. And it is absolutely something which the government have had open ears on. So I'm definitely not here to say that they will or won't do something, but it was very interesting that, you know, they've been talking much more openly about what could be done to, you know, back to your point, James, about supporting the local, domestic stock market. I was sitting at home a few weeks ago doing a Friday newsflow diary one, was quietly doing some stock work, and into my inbox pinged an invite from number 10 Downing Street to go and attend a round table specifically aimed at looking at ways to boost the attractiveness of the alternative investment market of AIM. Okay. And that to me was sort of almost manna from heaven in terms of, wow, you know, they really want to know, they really want to listen. That was not instigated by us. We were, it came completely out of the blue. So,
but this was just after they'd removed the tax benefits for IHT, right?
Well, but thanks, guys. It's very interesting though, because I think we've had, as an industry, we probably haven't been great at the lobbying effort over a very long period of time. Mm. And of course that it's really important to keep trying to make your point calmly and rationally to the people who are making very, very difficult decisions, let's be honest. Yeah. You know, all the decisions that they have to make at the moment are incredibly difficult, and we recognise that. But I suppose one thing about, you know, trying to impress on them the advantages of shifting the tide a little bit via levers that actually don't cost anything, but ultimately have a direct knock-on impact on economic growth, which you can come to in a second, you know, that starts to look like quite a nice, attractive option in a market where manoeuvrability is very limited due to pressure.
The other thing I wonder is, you know, certainly in recent times, having US equities has also benefited from a strengthening dollar.
Yes.
So, you know, in 2022, we were really protected actually from our, you know, client returns were a lot better than potentially they could have been because the dollar was so strong. You know, we got, if you looked at S&P returns versus actually our sterling returns.
The S&P fell 25%, didn't it?
Yeah, and we were nothing like that because sterling protected us.
Yes.
Sorry, because the dollar protected, but ultimately sterling weakened. So, you know, with the problems in the US at the moment, and actually we've seen it over the last month, if you look at dollar returns of S&P versus sterling returns, that's starting to reverse. And I wonder, you know, should there be a bit more volatility from the US, whether that will make people think about those companies a bit differently as well, because it can't continue, you know, unless we're that negative on the UK and we think sterling just continues to depreciate forever, then you know, maybe that could have a big impact as well. So
and I think it comes back to, over the very long term, thank you, that's a very good chart to come to at this point, but over the long term, buying assets at attractive valuations that you think can then go on and compound growth for many years into the future has been a winning trade. Overall, buying into assets at inflated prices, certainly in the short term, it might well come good in the very long run, but it might take you quite a long time to make up that overpaying for the asset in the first place. And so I think that the kind of issue that investors, and you know, you guys tell me, because you've had to deal with it from the kind of asset allocation kind of point of view, but my perception is that there has been, you know, a substantial difficulty on the part of asset allocators thinking, I kind of recognise that there's a lot of valuation risk being carried by the US market in particular, but not really being able to do a lot about it because the force of that trade and of being left behind put you at such a disadvantage in terms of client portfolios. So I think you're right in what you said in terms of that reassessment of the risk reward of that positioning has certainly, it's certainly come to the fore, hasn't it, as a debating point. I think people have almost been waiting for it, certainly in our discussions with clients. It feels like people have been waiting for it but have not been prepared to shift ahead of it. But now that it's there and it's really kind of starting to rear its head, that's quite
I think benchmarks risk, you know, benchmark and career risk, you know, benchmark risk and career risk. But, you know, I have sympathy for that US exposure because earnings growth has been so much better and projected earnings growth has been so much better. And yes, valuations were higher, but, you know, I know a lot's changed, but even starting this year, the anticipated growth from US earnings was 12%. You know, UK was, I think, 6 or 7. So you're still, you know, you're virtually looking at double the EPS expectations. And of course, you know, this you know, the exceptionalism trade in the US, I think people are properly questioning it, and I don't think it has been properly questioned before. And it doesn't, you know, it doesn't take much, I think, for the herd to change. But I think that's a, you know, in lots of businesses like ours, which have your, you know, your typically monthly asset allocation meetings, they're a lot more regular at the moment. But I think, you know, all those conversations are happening about how do we allocate for the next, you know, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, and what does the world look like? Is the US going to continue doing what it's done? And I think we're all questioning that a lot. Yeah. So,
and in terms of that discrepancy in growth rate as well, it's not necessarily a fair comparison to just compare the indices, because the composition of those indices, correct, in terms of the underlying sectoral composition is so different.
Yes.
And I suppose that the one point that we constantly make to our investors is that we aren't index investors. We're not passive investors. We're not just buying the UK index blindly. We're looking, hunting for the opportunities within the index that we think provide that ability to outpace the market in terms of their competitive advantage and ability to compound their returns over a long period of time. You know, that kind of comparing the high level indices is quite difficult. But I think this this chart that's, I think, up on everybody's screens right now is really interesting. It looks a little complex, but it can be explained in a very simple way. So this is sourced from Canaccord Genuity Quest. It's a data provider that we use heavily within our investment process. And Quest have a proprietary database which covers thousands of companies, tens of thousands of companies all across the world. And what they do for every individual company is construct a very long-term discounted cash flow model, which effectively takes 2 years of forecast data and then fades the company's returns to the cost of capital, and discounts that back to today's value to get what is a reasonable proxy of the intrinsic worth, should we call it, of each individual company. And the really interesting thing about them being doing it on an individual company basis is that, of course, you can then aggregate that data. You can look at the UK market versus the US market. You can look at UK small versus US small. You can look at the technology sector versus industrial sector and so on and so forth. And we've sort of tried to use this to illustrate to our clients over the last couple of years the extremity of the valuation dislocation in the UK as a whole, but in UK small cap in particular. So what the kind of graph there shows is it's comparing the aggregate intrinsic value of the UK stock market as a whole with the current market cap, the aggregate market cap of the businesses listed on there. And you can see in the gold circle that from where we sit today, the aggregate, if we compare those two figures in aggregate, you're sitting at a 17% discount to intrinsic value if you are the whole of the UK stock market. Yeah.
That's actually very similar to when Simon French was on. That was a very similar numbers. He did it slightly different. He did it like a sector adjusted valuation, and he came up to 20%, I think, didn't he? Yeah. Pretty much the same number.
And for UK small cap, which is the big green circle, you know, you can see that dislocation is even more extreme, 54% in terms of the discount to that cash flow based intrinsic value for the UK small cap segment. And if we compared that to the US market or other global markets, they sit at a premium to intrinsic value, significantly so in the case of the US, less so in terms of other global markets. I think we had that on a different chart if you wanted to, there we go, to pull it up. So the US all was at a 35% premium to intrinsic value. We showed it there as downside from current equity levels down to the intrinsic value. US small still looks expensive, 21% downside to that intrinsic value. Europe ex UK is more sort of fair, finely balanced, but Asia Pacific, you can see as well, they're in the red, so looking at 14% downside to intrinsic value. So, you know, structural differences in those markets aside, which might account for an element of that dislocation, I think we would argue very strongly that the UK at the moment, at such an uncertain juncture of kind of global macroeconomic positioning, looks as if it has at least a very significant degree of insurance there from valuation, from those low starting valuations, whereas arguably many other markets around the world look the other way.
Mm. Well, I think we've probably exhausted ourselves on small cap, haven't we? But what you're saying is it's really cheap. Everyone's been selling it for ages and there's no one left to sell. And things might not be as bad as they seem. And over the very long term, small cap's done very well. Is that fair?
Absolutely. And in a sense, you know, why should we care that their share prices are on the floor, outside of the fact that historically, if we look back at that long-term return chart, it looks like a great place to, from a starting point from which to invest. Well, I think there are, you know, if we sit back and we think about it from the point of view of people living in the United Kingdom, I'm a passionate believer that it matters that we support growing businesses and provide them with capital at the right stage of their evolution, provide them with funding opportunities, funding optionality at the right point in their journey. And unfortunately, the position in which we found ourselves has meant that there have been significant constraints to that. You know, they've seen their cost of capital rise quite significantly, which has put them at an active disadvantage to other global businesses in their sectors. And in addition, you know, a lot of them now have been constrained in terms of their flexibility on capital allocation. So obviously, if we think about what a company can do with its excess capital, it can invest it in their business, it can invest it organically in productivity improvements or growth initiatives, it can, you know, it can certainly buy other companies with it, but it can also give it back to investors either in the form of a dividend or it can buy back its own stock and cancel it, thereby shrinking the number of shares in the company and artificially inflating the value of the earnings per share.
Yeah.
And increasingly, businesses right across the cap scale in the UK have been doing exactly that, which is totally rational in the view of, and it's good from my point of view as an investor in terms of helping to support you know, share price performance and valuation. But if we think about it, take a step back from us living in the UK, that is not an economically productive use of capital, right? We want those businesses to be reinvesting it. We want them to be driving economic growth and productivity. And what better place to look to drive that, and which is a key mission of the government, right, than to support those growth businesses that are based all the way up and down the country. I think our stat is that 2/3 of the businesses in our smaller companies fund are based outside of the Greater London area. So they're right from Scotland down to, you know, the sort of West Country. Yeah. So they're based all around the country and they are actively supporting job creation and investment in those local communities. So personally, you know, if I take a step back from my investment, with having my investment hat on, I just think about the kind of country I want to create for my kids when they grow up. You know, I want to support that. I'm a passionate believer that it's a great thing to have a functioning junior company stock market. And I'd love to see the government get behind that message over the next couple of months.
Do you think the government's just ignored what's happened in markets and sort of thought it will sort itself out almost? But I mean, the IHT or the business property relief rules have been in place, and arguably if you look at performance, you know, I'm not sure it's been particularly supportive.
No, I think some of it, it's hard to argue with that statement if I'm honest, but from here on in, I think I'm optimistic that they have increasingly recognised the scale of the problem and why it matters and are increasingly minded to do something about it. So appreciate where we've come from, but let's all look forward and try and think positively and constructively about where we could go from here.
I mean,
it's definitely recognition.
We need growth. You know, the country is screaming for growth.
Yeah.
You know, we've got debt that needs to be paid down. We've got job creation that's required. You know, we need this, but it at times, and I'm sure you've been doing it more than us at times, it's just banging your head against a brick wall with it. It's frustrating, but you know, usually that could picture, you know, we had on the last podcast, we had our emotional roller coaster.
We did.
Perhaps we were at the capitulation phase when everyone gives up.
And, so, you know, we were in that.
And then that's, you know, that's the time actually when things rebound.
And we were in that Downing Street meeting, and one of our investee companies in the smaller companies fund was there as well, a business called Cohort, which is in the defence technology space. So obviously very, very topical for the government as well at the moment.
Yeah.
So effectively it's a mini conglomerate, if you want to call it that, of smaller defence technology businesses. There are seven of them within their portfolio, with the aim that those more niche businesses can then benefit from being part of a group with greater scale. Been listed since, I think, 2006. And when talking about that very uncertainty that was posed by the will they, won't they on IHT relief, the chief executive of the business, Andy Thomas, said, sort of put up his hand and he said, look, you know, I can vouch firsthand for the fact that it does have an impact on the businesses, not just on the share prices, but on the businesses' growth plans, because he was in the very throes of trying to buy an Australian business as all of that happened and as the uncertainty got exacerbated at the sort of run-up to the autumn statement last year. And he said, look, I was told in no uncertain terms by my broker, you cannot go out and raise capital from the market until we know what's going to happen with it. So thereby delaying it for, let's say, a couple of weeks or a month. And he said, look, you know, that almost cost me buying the business. That is not a good place to be for the sake of, you know, arbitrary levels of uncertainty around this tax break. So, and I think that message was really landing. You know, they wanted to hear solutions for what could be done to improve that, the experience of businesses on the market, remove barriers to their growth and to them being listed on that market, which is really encouraging to see.
Well, fingers crossed, but it's certainly an interesting opportunity in UK small cap if things just get a little bit less bad. and we can all...
I mean, that's the thing. It's a great starting point.
Yeah.
You know, you think about downside risk and upside potential and you're weighted the right way on it.
Yep.
That's the way to think about it, isn't it? So
good. Well, we better call it a day because he's got a presentation to go to.
So, I have.
Victoria, thank you for your time. That was really interesting.
You.
That was excellent.
Thank you for having
keep
me.
Up the good work in UK Small Cap. And thanks everyone for joining us this week. Any questions, let me know on jonathan.raymond@quartertivia.com and we'll see you next time. Thanks very much. Bye bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.